Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what factors led to Western dominance of the world and how are they now changing? And then on the Scholar Circle, how might the power of ideas shape countries and international power structures? We are joined by Stanford University historian and classics professor Ian Morris, who has looked to the beginning of history to answer the question of why the West rules for now, the patterns of history and what they reveal about the future, which is the title of his book. Welcome, Ian Morris.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
I think the place we should start is what you mean by the West and the East and how you define them and why you settled on an East-West dichotomy for this book.
There's been all these debates about why the West came to dominate the world. And a lot of these debates break down because people are defining the terms in different sorts of ways. One person will say it's all about democracy or it's all about Christianity. Somebody else will say we need to look at a totally different set of factors. So I tried to figure out what are the debates about Western domination really about. It seemed to me what they're really about is the ability of societies to impose their will on the world, to get things done, master their physical and intellectual environments. You know, the best way to think about this over the long term of history was by attempting to measure social development over time. And I decided the best way to go about doing this was to look back over the history of social development, to find the point at which you first begin to see really different ways of living and lifestyles in different parts of the world. This comes about 15,000 years ago, the end of the Ice Age, as the world begins to warm up. And in certain parts of the world, people are able to begin domesticating plants and animals. And as they do so, they have access to just a lot more energy than ever before. And the populations get bigger and bigger. And the societies get more and more complex and more different from each other. I looked around the world at the places where these processes began. And it's really a very limited number. As the populations grow, these areas get bigger and bigger, and the farming and cities and states and empires spreads out from these original cores. And so I took the westernmost of these core areas in the old world, which really starts up in what we now think of as Southwest Asia. All the societies that descend from this westernmost core, I'm going to call Western societies, and all the societies are modern complex societies that have descended from the easternmost core, which is out in China, I'm going to call those Eastern societies. Because in fact, the societies that have had the highest levels of social development in the last 15,000 years have always been ones that descended either from the original Western core area or from the original Eastern core area.
In today's language, you hear much more discussion about the global north and the global south. So, for example, the global north kind of exploiting the global south. Do you think that the East-West is sort of expiring and opening way for a north-south debate?
Well, I think the north-south debate is a really important way of understanding why the world is the shape that it is, kind of why the distribution of wealth and power are as they are. This is something Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, does a wonderful job at tackling the north-south question, asking, you know, why is it that societies in the northern hemisphere are so much richer than those in the southern hemisphere? He goes back to the end of the Ice Age to identify why complex societies began developing first in the northern hemisphere and then went on to become so powerful there. He's less focused on the question of why it is within the northern part of the world that in the last couple of hundred years, it was Western societies rather than any others that went on to dominate the whole planet. So I guess the question I was asking in my book was more focused within the northern part of the world. Why is it the Western societies? If you go back a couple of hundred years, we see this great surge in wealth and power beginning in Western Europe, spreading quickly to European colonies overseas, like North America. And then in the 20th century, though, we've seen the rapid spread of these levels of industrialization and social development and wealth around the rest of the world. And the last 50 years or so have been seen a billion people in East Asia lifted out of extreme poverty as more and more wealth flows into those societies. And I think what we're going to see across the next 50 years will be the continuation of this. East Asian societies will continue to get richer. Areas like Southeast Asia, South Asia, at the moment just beginning to climb onto the same ladder. They're going to do so much more fully. I think we're going to see India, Pakistan becoming much more important players on the global scene. And increasingly, I think large parts of Africa seem to be moving in the same direction. You know, we often tend to think of Africa as just this disaster story. And you know, what we see on the news is always about coups and massacres and disease. But in fact, the last 10 years or so, Africa has seen fairly remarkable economic growth. General standards of living have started to rise a lot faster.
There are a couple of things I think we should discuss. One is, you said historians really weren't looking quite far enough back in order to discern the pattern that might really be occurring. And then the second thing is that you said, well, there is the role of the Industrial Revolution, but it really rests within these other three paradigms. It's deeper. It's biology, it's sociology, and geography. So why don't we start with the historian issue? And, I mean, you went all the way back to the beginning of the universe.
Yes. Yeah, which is a long way to go back.
It really is.
Winston Churchill had this line, the farther backward you look, the farther forward you're likely to see. I think this is absolutely true. If you want to be able to look at enough of history to be able to see what the big patterns are like, you need to combine the methods of the archaeologist with those of the historian, taking in the whole prehistoric period. And certainly, I think you need to go back at least as far as the end of the Ice Age, 15,000 years ago. There's really three things you need to know about to explain the history of the world. One of these is biology, which, of course, tells us what we are. We are clever chimpanzees, and our humans are all much the same wherever you find them in the world. I think this is the big lesson of biology. The second thing I suggest you need to know about is sociology, which I use in a rather loose sense in the book to basically mean the full range of the social sciences, which I think tells you how humans in large groups behave. And if you put those two together, you get a kind of generalizing theory about all of humanity at all times and all places, why it is that humans have been so successful at doing certain kinds of things, why it is that societies have changed so much, and why sometimes the societies don't change, and why sometimes we see great collapses rather than steadily rising social development. The problem with a sort of biological, sociological theory is if you want to know why some societies have developed so much faster and further than others, for that, I think the third element you need to add in is the geography. It's the different places that make all the difference. That people are all much the same. The societies they live in all develop along much the same lines. But the fact that the societies are in different places leads them to different outcomes. When you can see enough of human history, what you realize is that biology, sociology, geography, put together, these basically answer our questions.
Let's back up and look at these a little bit more closely. You say biology matters because?
That sort of tells us what it is that we do in the world. What we do, I think, is really not that different from what other animals, or perhaps you might even say all other life forms do. We need to extract energy from the world around us, otherwise we simply die. When we can extract more energy than we need just to keep puttering along, we tend either to turn it into bigger versions of ourselves. So we've always seen this in the last 30 or 40 years. People are getting just bigger and bigger and bigger. And in fact, it goes back a couple of hundred years. 200 years ago, the average adult, pretty much anywhere in the world you look, is about 6 inches shorter than they are now. In the last 200 years, we've been able to capture so much energy from the world and convert it into food that we've just made ourselves bigger. When we're not busy doing that, animals tend to convert extra energy into just more of themselves. And humans, of course, have done exactly the same thing. We differ, though, from the other animals in that our evolution has produced this weird brain, which is really nothing quite like the brains in other animals. And it's so complex and so big that it allowed us to invent cultural evolution. Any other kind of animal in the world, they have basically one way of doing things. Gorillas have one way of organizing their societies. Chimpanzees have one way of doing this. And wherever you look at a chimp or a gorilla, it's basically the same kind of society. Humans, of course, aren't like that. And we are able to respond to what happens in the environment around us by changing our societies. So we can go from simple hunter-gatherer bands to more complicated, more hierarchical peasant societies, to very hierarchical empires, and then to modern industrial societies, which in some ways are much less hierarchical than peasant or imperial societies.
And so that would bring us to the sociology. You cite a science fiction writer, Robert Heinlein, who says that we're essentially lazy people and that you think that the change is due to laziness, greediness, and fear.
That's right. Robert Heinlein, back in the early 1970s, came up with this saying that people often call the Heinlein theorem. Progress is caused by, you know, lazy, frightened people. Nowadays, we'd probably want to be a bit more cautious about the evaluation valuation terms. I think most of the time we don't really know what the effects of our actions are going to be. But the most of our actions, I think, can be broken down under these three headings of fear, greed, and sloth.
I also wonder if that's only part of it, and there's really this other side that would be less cynical, the kind of ingeniousness, inventiveness, and altruism also motivating people. And I'm thinking of great science, great philosophers, great statesmen who also have shaped history.
Yes, it doesn't seem to me to be all that cynical. This, of course, is one of the ways in which we are different from other animals. We're more ingenious, and even more important, we are able to preserve some of our ingenuity because we have modern speech. We've now, of course, got writing and all the technologies associated with that. So we can pass these things on and teach to other people and to future generations what we have learned ourselves. The fact that, you know, humans can have an Isaac Newton, whereas chimpanzees can't. This is obviously an important part of history. But when I started looking at the big span of human history, it seemed to me that one of the most striking things is this question of what is it that drives the great episodes of ingenuity, the Isaac Newton type episodes. And when you start burrowing into the details, the ingenuity tends to be driven all the time by these factors of sort of fear, greed, and laziness. It's people respond to the challenges that the world puts in front of them. And these challenges, it might create a situation where you say, aha, I make some kind of new widget. I start doing what I'm doing in a different way. This will maybe allow me to get by without having to work as much. And I think this probably has a lot to do with the agricultural revolution initially. People figuring out ways to get higher yields from plants without having to wander around the countryside gathering food quite so much. Or it might be that, say, you're in a situation of climatic change and the traditional ways of doing things just aren't feeding your family anymore. And so you're becoming very fearful. And this is a great spur to innovation and invention. Or you may find that you simply are blundering into discoveries. And so when I look back over the history of the great men, the great women who've made the inventions and launched the wars and so on, what I found over and over again was that it's the changing environment around the people that drives them to make these great discoveries or do these terrible things to each other.
And so that leads us to the last piece, which you say is geography. You say what distinguishes the destinies is tied to geography. You start with the Earth's orbit.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the Earth's orbit is a rather more complicated thing than we normally tend to assume. But the processes, of course, are unfolding very slowly. The Earth wobbles and shakes on its axis as it goes around the Sun. This, over the long run, produces these great cycles in climate, which have had an enormous impact on the way that the societies have developed. As I worked my way through history, looking at the big episodes of change, again and again I found that it was geography that seemed to be in the driving seat. And geography was what was thrusting the great challenges onto people, which forced them to be creative or destructive or whatever the case might be. But it also dawned on me that the reason why I think often historians haven't always seen the importance of geography in the bigger story is that geography itself works in a rather complicated way. I think it's a two-way street, this relationship between geography and society. Because on the one hand, geography determines how societies develop, and where you are in the world is the single most important factor in determining how quickly it's going to develop and what precise direction. But at the same time, the way societies develop determines what the geography means. And so some geographical facts that in one period of development might be a very difficult thing for you, creates all kinds of problems. In another period, can suddenly become this enormous plus. The classic example of this would be, say, about 600 years ago, around the year 1400. If you were dropped down into Western Europe in 1400, you would find that it was a pretty marginal place. It's a long way from the real centers of action, where China is the real center in 1400. The Mediterranean basin is a fairly important center. And Western Europe is stuck out into the cold waters of the North Atlantic, long way away. Basically, nothing very important is going on there. Then that suddenly changes, and all of a sudden, sticking into the Atlantic Ocean goes from being this disadvantage, it makes you a long way from where everything is happening, into suddenly being a huge plus. And the thing that happens is that in Eastern Asia, social development is rising so high and Chinese society is becoming so creative and inventive that the Chinese come up with two great new inventions in the 13th and 14th centuries. One is ocean-going ships, which allow you to cross entire oceans. And the other is guns that work, which allow you to shoot the people you meet when you get to the other side of the ocean. And these things spread like wildfire across Eurasia. Within 40 years of the first known gun in China, the first known guns are also showing up in Western Europe. And once this happens, once development reaches the point that these new inventions come in, all of a sudden, the fact that Western Europe sticks out into the Atlantic goes from being this bad thing to being this enormous plus. Because now Europeans find that they are only about 3,000 miles away from the Americas, whereas people in East Asia, to sail with the winds and the tides, you're going to have to cover at least 6,000, probably 8,000 miles to get to the Americas. And because people are all basically the same and societies are all develop along rather similar paths, the fact that it's so much easier for the West Europeans to get to the Americas and the East Asians means that it's the West Europeans who do it first. And the West Europeans colonize the Americas and plunder the Americas and draw the Americas into an economic system based on Western Europe. I suggest that that's what then really propels the West to the top of the pile, this new economic system they create, because geography changes its meaning. And if you look back through human history, all the way back to the end of the Ice Age, you see this sort of process going on again and again and again. Geography drives how the societies develop. But as the societies develop, that changes what the geography means.
So let's take all of these patterns that you have found and apply it to the modern day crises in some way, because we're dealing with a lot of issues. We're dealing with dwindling resources in some cases. We're dealing with climate change. You suggest that we're seeing certainly a rise of the East. How do you see this affecting the future in terms of all of the big crises we're facing?
Once you understand the role that geography has played in world history, the rise of the East starts to become very understandable. The kind of geographical forces that propelled, first of all, Western Europe and then North America to global dominance, these have continued operating, and they're now drawing in East Asia as well. East Asia is starting to gain on the Western world in power and wealth. When you've looked at history, there are really two lessons you can draw. And one is that you can identify the patterns that have driven history, and you can project these forces forward into the future and ask you, what will happen if current and recent trends continue operating in more or less the same way? Where will the world be in 100 years' time if we're just in a kind of steady state of change? The other thing you can do is, when you look back over history, you find that the forces of social development very often generate forces which then undermine social development. It's like societies create their own problems to a great extent. You solve one problem, it just creates a new problem to solve. And so I think you can combine these two trends, the big forces that drive history plus the counter forces that generates, to get at least a rough sense of where things are likely to go. If we just project trends forward, then within the next 100 years or so, Eastern social development is going to catch up with Western social development. Certainly by the end of the century, the world's centers of wealth and power will have shifted away from North America and toward East Asia. I also suggest, though, that if we do that thing, project recent trends forward, what it suggests is that by the time the Eastern development catches up with the Western, levels of social development will have risen so high that the world is going to be completely different from anything we can now imagine. The scale of changes in the 21st century will just beggar all the changes we've seen in the last 15,000 years. It's going to be an extraordinary time. The future just won't be like the present. So I think that's one possible outcome. If the forces that have shaped history up till now just carry on working. But like I say, the problem with that is that development tends to generate forces that undermine it. And so when we look at the great crises going on in the world today, a lot of the forces that are so disruptive now are exactly the same ones that have been enormous problems for rapidly changing societies in the past. So climate change is one of them. Mass migration, often driven by climate change, is one of the forces we may have to deal with in the 21st century. New epidemic diseases, again, over and over again in the past, this has been an important force of disaster. large-scale famine. The pressure on food resources around the world has really been increasing in the last few years. And then the collapse of states is the fifth of these forces, which, of course, we're seeing happening around us at an accelerating rate. We've seen the collapse of states in the Middle East, not yet clear what's going to come out of these upheavals. So I think you can see a lot of the same forces that have operated in the past continuing to operate in the 21st century. I think the big question is which path is going to win out? Is it going to be some great transformation of societies, or are we heading for some kind of catastrophe?
And your answer to that?
I'm guardedly optimistic. I think that the biggest thing we have to worry about is not so much forces like climate change in themselves as how humans react to these forces. And you know, it's very easy to put together scenarios where climate change can drive governments do really rash things in response to it. Can set off wars as it triggers mass migrations. It's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility that we will see a major nuclear war in the 21st century. We often tend to assume that since the fall of the Soviet Union, that's kind of off the table. I think that's a little optimistic. It may not be off the table. I take some encouragement, though, by the way that the Cold War ended. If we've been having this conversation 50 years ago, and I'd said to you, in 50 years' time, the Soviet Union's leaders will have looked at communism and looked at the economic development of the USSR, we give up. We'll just unravel the whole thing, we'll dismantle our empire in Eastern Europe, and we'll all go home. You would have thought I was mad. And yet that's exactly what did happen. And so I tend to think that if we were able to make it through a crisis like that, then we really ought to be able to deal with the kinds of challenges we're facing in the 21st century, too.
I want you to talk about two last things. One is, at the end of your book, you talk about a lot of the technological developments. You talk about genetic advancements. You talk about these computer capacities that, quoting Ray Kurzweil, these are powerful enough to run programs reproducing the 10,000 trillion electrical signals that flash every second among the 22 billion neurons in a human skull. That was his quote. And then you talk about DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, the research into modifying humans, the Silent Talk Project, IBM's project. There are a lot of these really, on one hand, fascinating developments, on the other hand, frightening developments. And then you talk about the concept of getting to a point of singularity. Talk about what some of these projects are and what they mean for society. And then talk about your concept of singularity and how that plays into this.
So this all came out of this idea of, what if we take the trends that we've seen in history and project them forward across the 21st century? Where will this take us? And so one of the things, like I said, is that I think we will see Eastern development catching up with Western development. But then the other interesting thing about this was seeing just how high in terms of social development things are going to rise across the 21st century if change keeps accelerating at the rate we've seen in the last 100 years. As I was running my calculations, looking into this and thinking about where is this taking us, that led me on to looking at the work of some of the futurists who've been speculating on where recent trends are taking us. And generally, I tend to think that when you're looking at predictions of the future, any specific prediction is likely to be a million miles wide of the mark. If you look back at what people were writing 100 years ago, most of the time it's pretty funny. But on the other hand, when you look at the sort of general trends that scientists are talking about, then I think we are on much safer ground in talking about where the future may be taking. And the most striking of these trends, I think, is these linked revolutions in genetics and nanotechnology and robotics. And like you're saying, one of the ideas people often discuss is Ray Kurzweil's suggestion that the power of our ability to scan the human brain and the power of these biggest supercomputers we're building are both increasing exponentially. And if you plot out where these trends are taking us, Kurzweil suggests that within the next decade, we're going to see scanning so powerful, we can actually reproduce a map of any specific human brain as a piece of software, basically. And within the next 20 years, we'll have computers powerful enough that can run that software. So this, in a sense, this would mean you personally could be duplicated on a silicon platform rather than on a carbon-based platform, which is what you currently are, a carbon-based, biologically evolved creature. Within the next 40 years, we ought to see supercomputers so powerful that they could pool maps of all of the human brains in the world and kind of merge all of human intelligence into a single machine-based intelligence, which would have trillions of times the thinking power of all the humans in the world currently combined. Which astonishing vision of the future. And I sort of suspect that as a specific prediction, things probably won't turn out that way. But this general direction is where things seem at the moment to be going if the historical trends continue. And so, yeah, I mean, the DARPA, the Defense Research Agency that you mentioned, one of the things they're currently working on is a way to do a very Kurzweil type of thing, but put implants into the skulls of soldiers so that these implants will be able to read the electrical signals flashing around in your brain, which, of course, are your thoughts, which you then verbalize by sending further electrical signals that ultimately come to your tongue and allow you to speak. But the implants will kind of intercept these electrical signals, and then send them over the internet as electrical signals to the implant in the brain of some other soldier. So you'll be producing what they like to call network-enhanced telepathy, which sounds like Robert Heinlein, sounds like complete science fiction. But an NSF report just a couple of years ago was fairly confident in predicting that we should see this during the 2020s. That, of course, is just one example of the many, many things that are going on. This is why I end up the book by suggesting that if these sorts of trends continue, we're looking at some kind of transformation of humanity in directions utterly different from anything that's happened in the past. If the transformations don't continue in that direction, we then have to ask ourselves what might conceivably stop them. And when we start thinking about the kinds of disasters that would need to be unleashed in order to cut off these transformations, and then we also start thinking about the kinds of weapons we now have in the world, that is when the scenario begins to get a bit scary.
And as for the singularity concept...
Yeah, this is an idea of Ray Kurzweil's that he picked up from earlier philosophers. The idea that you reach a point in time where change becomes so fast that it basically becomes instantaneous. So things simply disappear even as they get formed. New things get invented, they are immediately outdating themselves. And his idea is that as we see the development of these totally new kinds of computing intelligence that really can think for themselves, they will be reinventing themselves on this timescale so fast that it will appear that change is happening instantaneously. Which, again, sounds like a very science fiction kind of thing. Except that I think if you think about the world we live in now, the rate of change that we're experiencing now, and we're coming to take for granted now, would have just been unimaginable to somebody living 1,000 years ago. And the sort of things that we've become accustomed to, I mean, like talking on the telephone right now, or listening to the radio, or let alone going onto the internet, or getting on a jet plane to fly to another continent, this would have just seemed like magic 1,000 years ago. Things we take so much for granted now, like television, would have just seemed unimaginable. Perhaps the sort of changes that are implied by the extraordinary transformations that might be coming in the 21st century, these perhaps are not quite so unthinkable as we might at first assume.
Ian Morris is a professor of classics and history at Stanford University. His latest book is called Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. When we come back, the power of ideas to shape countries, foreign policies, and the world. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. How do ideas shape political realities? How do they interact with other, more concrete factors to drive political agendas and then shape countries and international relations? How might the reinterpretation or misinterpretation of these ideas and concepts change the course of history? We're joined by three experts. Elizabeth Borgwart is a professor at Washington University and the University of Chicago. She is author of A New Deal for the World, America's Vision for Human Rights, and the forthcoming The Nuremberg Idea, Crimes Against Humanity in History, Law, and Politics. Tim Lynch is professor in the School of Social Sciences and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He is author of a number of publications, including Turf War, the Clinton Administration and Northern Ireland, and the forthcoming Cambridge Essential History of Post-Cold War U.S. Foreign Policy. Christopher McKnight Nichols is a fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and professor of history at Oregon State University. He is author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. The main purpose of this is to look at this evolution of U.S. foreign policy and how we got to where we are today. And each of you have looked at this different eras and also from different approaches. And I thought one of the places to start would be with Liz Borgwart. You led one of your articles with how ideas themselves affect the future.
And it's not so much ideas on their own, but ideas as energizing institutions, as energizing individuals or social movements, the way ideas connect and interact with other factors. I think the classic image is the sociologist Max Weber saying that ideas are never going to be the coal that fires the engine of that train of history, but they can be the tracks that the train goes on. And obviously, where the tracks are really affects what the destination is, that you where you wind up.
I'm going to ask you to give some examples in a minute, but I think maybe where we should start in looking at that is Chris McKnight Nichols. You have looked at these concepts, ideas, and their interpretations of, say, isolationism, internationalism, and how much people's ideas about the ideas have affected what the United States has become as a world player and how that has, of course, affected the rest of the world, starting with maybe even the founders.
I agree with Liz Borgwart that ideas really matter, and ideas may matter in some ways more in foreign policy. So I would start with sort of two maybe fundamental precepts of that. That on the one hand, ideas matter to the masses. This is true from 1776 as it is to now. That is, sort of mass ideologies legitimize the roles that policymakers can take on. And then ideas clearly matter to the policymakers themselves. They frame the tracks. They frame the system of how individuals and groups, the train of state, to continue that metaphor, where it can go. So just to lay out a few of the more specific yet abstract ideas that have informed sort of revolutionary policymakers and others, there's always been a kind of ideological fervor and what you might call a messianic streak in American foreign policy. And you might also note then, too, that there's been something that we are really recently, historians and individuals throughout the world are greatly interested in, and that is kind of thinking about what Jefferson called in the Declaration of Independence, decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Now, certainly, American foreign policy hasn't always, or perhaps even often, cared that much about the respect for the opinions of mankind, but that has also been a major part of American foreign policy making. And I would add as well, pragmatism, or sort of a more diminished form of pragmatism, that is a willingness to compromise and achieve vital goals, has been something that unites Washington, Adams, Jefferson, to far later followers in their footsteps, like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, and others.
It seems like in your book that it's also the reinterpretation of those original concepts that have shaped eras and directions. Like, what do they really mean? So the meanings about the concepts.
Absolutely. There may be sort of nothing more American than a sort of a sensibility of the nation's own exceptionality, which is often referenced through the early American Republic, the early history of the Republic. In terms of foreign policy, my work, I single out three what I call policy pillars. Those are Washington's farewell address in 1796, Jefferson's first inaugural address in 1801, and the Monroe Doctrine of 1823. And these are referenced for virtually every policymaker thereafter, regardless of the direction they want to take the country. They try to update the model of steering clear of foreign entanglements, to paraphrase, for each era.
It seems like we've gone quite a ways in the other direction from that. Tim Lynch, let's bring you in.
Well, I'd agree with much of that. I think it's worth restating that the United States is an idea. There is no United States until they have a revolution predicated on this idea. We know that other nations have had revolutions and have been animated by some very profound ideologies and very problematic ones, but the nation predates them. So if you looked at the English Revolution, the French, the Russian, the Chinese, these revolutions don't create the nation. America is created by its idea, by its ideology, and as a consequence, it's more prone, in this sense I think it is exceptional, it's more prone to ideological behavior and ideational discourse than most other nations, even though these other nations have had very well-defined periods of ideological behavior. You think of the Nazis, you think of fascism, communism, whereas the United States has this ideology, but in some strange way it's become powerful as a state because of its pragmatism as well as its ideology. It's understanding how these two things relate to each other and balance each other, complement each other, that is necessary for explaining the overall success of American foreign policy over the long term.
And you say success of American foreign policy, which I'm assuming you mean by the U.S. becoming such a large global player world.
I think it's a very simple metric. And even those that have a downer on current expression of American power, it's gone from being a diddly squat trading outpost on the eastern seaboard of British North America to being not just an important global power, but the most powerful nation in world history. Now, I know geography has something to do with that, and climate and the absence of neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. But it also has something to do with its foreign policy and how it's dealt with the world. All the other competitor states, Russia, China, Britain, France, Spain, they all had notions, universalist notions of their model, and they've become not irrelevant to world history, but they played a secondary role. And we can debate how far this is going to endure. But the American system prospered. It went from nothing to really being everything, whilst the competitors failed. And I think that's got something to do with its foreign policy.
Tim makes a fascinating series of points about American exceptionalism, which has been very much in the news of late. And, you know, it reminds me of the opposition between traditional ideas about American exceptionalism, that it had a lot to do with having a frontier, for instance, the famous Frederick Jackson Turner thesis from the previous century, and the idea that because of the frontier, Americans could sort of remake themselves at any given moment. And then you have more modern ideas about American exceptionalism, like the, I know I'm quoting so many sociologists today, but Seymour Martin Lipset saying, you know, there's a basket of values that can be considered quintessentially American, notably individualism, and that if you subscribe to these values, that makes you American, because it's an ideationally oriented idea, American exceptionalism. It's not just that, there are frontiers other places too, right? Brazil had a frontier. Russia had a frontier. So maybe these ideas about being separated by oceans and having frontiers are necessary but not sufficient, maybe even similarly with having a revolution. But some of the ideas that Tim is talking about synthesize to make, what's the difference that makes a difference, I think is an exciting question.
That would bring in the question of these ideologies and how they have shaped the direction of leadership. For example, Liz, you talked about FDR advancing the human rights movement without really meaning to.
Right. It's much in the way that Professor Chris Nichols just articulated. In my book, I also use as a jumping off point a particular document. It was called the Atlantic Charter of 1941. It's not nearly as well known as the documents that Chris just referenced, but basically it was a statement of war and peace aims. And what's cool about that is that it was negotiated in August of 1941, which is, of course, before the United States is in the war, right? So it's before Pearl Harbor. So what is FDR doing, negotiating with Churchill a set of aims for the post-war, you know, what the world is going to look like after this war is over, that the United States isn't even in yet. And human rights were central to that vision in a way that went beyond just sort of generalizing the rights that we find, for instance, in the U.S. Bill of Rights.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, let's bring you back in. And in addition to this trajectory, I'm also curious about the sort of ebb and flow that you noted in your book, particularly with the anti-imperialists and the isolationists who were pacifists, and how they have shaped, or not shaped, really where we are today.
So one thing that I often point out when I talk about my work on the subject is that humanitarianism is a relatively newcomer to the ideology, foreign policy kind of nexus. And it's the first moments of thinking about humanitarian intervention in the American context come with America's rise to world power in the late 19th century. And in particular, the sort of prism there is about the Spanish-American War and Spanish atrocities against Cubans. But of course, there's a notable blind spot as well that we see emerging right at that very first sort of genesis moment, and that is a blind spot towards American, not particularly humane activities, say in the Philippines and otherwise. For instance, the advent of waterboarding in American military affairs is actually in the context of the counterinsurgency against Filipino revolutionaries. But in terms of the ebb and flow here, you have from the late 19th century through the present, I hate to call it poles, but you see sort of hybrids of different visions. So on the one hand, you have those who oppose interventions abroad, generally speaking, and others who embrace them on a wide array of terms. So what I try to do in my book is to show the genesis of modern ideas about isolationism and show their actual relationship to new visions of internationalism. So for example, in the 1920s and 1930s, you have fascinating alliances between so-called isolationists, like the Republican senator from Idaho, William Borah, a staunch isolationist, the so-called irreconcilable, with pacifist internationalists, like the settlement house worker and reformer Jane Addams and Emily Balch, the first two women, actually, first two American women to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And they worked together for the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928 to outlaw war, for example. So what this shows us, I think, is that isolationism and internationalism were less of a binary and could often be combined in how Americans, policymakers and activists thought about their nation's role in the world.
Tim Lynch.
I'd agree with that. In some ways, these stereotypically oppositional concepts of isolationism and interventionism are both products of exceptionalism. You seek American isolationism because America is special and different and shouldn't be sullied by contact with the outside world. And by using the same rationale, you demand intervention to make the world in America's image. There's a common core. I mean, I think in some ways, and perhaps I don't want to overplay this, but there's a far greater complementarity in some of these quite differing understandings of what the nature of American power is, which has actually been very helpful in crafting what I've described as an effective foreign policy over the long term. Other nations tend to get sucked into very contrasting positions. I don't want to overuse the German analogy, but clearly in its history, it's had periods where it's looked outwards and periods where it's looked inwards, and these have had a markedly different impact on the quantum of German power. Whereas in the American case, America has got stronger in some ways because of the interplay of these two forces that seemingly pull in the opposite direction. I'm partial to Walter Russell Mead's model. He outlines these four different foreign policy traditions, but his point is not that they are separate and distinct and cause dissensus and schizophrenia, but they work together over the long term. And that's why you're obliged to account for more success in the American story than you are its absence.
Given where we are today and given this ideology and the idea and hope that the U.S. is actually a moral place, and the contradictions with things like what Chris mentioned in terms of the torture and the waterboarding and the massive amounts of deaths that have come as a result of some of the foreign policies, how do we reconcile the ideas and the rhetoric with the reality? Liz Borgwardt, I'm going to throw this to you.
Rhetoric can very often bootstrap reality. It's not a static snapshot of the relationship of rhetoric and reality. When I talk about that very aspirational document I just mentioned, the Atlantic Charter of 1941, you know, I'm sometimes asked when I speak about it, well, was it rhetoric or was it reality? And I feel like, well, what should I say? That it was, you know, 75% rhetoric and 25% reality. And like, that's the answer. No, I mean, when ideas are put out there, they inspire people, they change behavior, people get together, they form groups, they pressure decision makers, and it sort of circles back to, there's a sort of human impulse to reduce cognitive dissonance, I think, by sometimes slightly bringing the rhetoric and the reality into closer alignment. And one quick example that I would give would be, because we're historians, right, I'm going to give a historical example, but from the mid-70s, when the United States was negotiating with the then-Soviet Union in Helsinki, Finland, and you had this Helsinki Accord that was supposedly toothless and had all these human rights provisions, that's why the Soviets agreed to it, because there were no enforcement provisions. But it sparked, in many ways, a human rights revolution, because people started to believe that, you know, these Helsinki watch groups sprung up all over the world, all over Eastern Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, people started writing, you know, poems about human rights and having human rights plays in their basement. And the rhetoric, in effect, changed the reality, because it reshaped people's perceptions and expectations and even their culture.
Did we also see that here within the U.S., Chris McKnight-Nichols?
Absolutely. I'm struck both by the fact that rhetoric does play out in altering the terms of politics, domestic as well as foreign policy. So one connection here that we haven't yet made is between domestic and foreign policy. That is, used to be said that partisan politics stopped at water's edge. This was a classic phrase that policymakers noted. And yet, in fact, as we all know as citizens and as human beings, we tend to frame political rhetoric and political decision-making in terms of both domestic and foreign. That is, one of the ways in which we think many individuals debated the Iraq War, the yearly costs of the Iraq War, was to think in terms of limited resources and the fact that roughly the yearly burn rate for four of the first 4 years or so was something in the order of $30 to $35 billion a year. That happens to be about the same amount as universal health care. Now, we know this is a false quid pro quo, but thinking about the rhetoric of foreign policy, of these commitments abroad, often has a domestic reference. So, for example, thinking back in the past, the racial reformer W.E.B. Du Bois argued that, quote, civilization begins at home, that the kind of rhetoric of civilizing other peoples and other nations, the sort of manifest destiny justifications that American policymakers were putting forward, in fact, had a clear corollary at home, and that is you can't go abroad to enact civilization and fulfill American democratic ideals until you fulfill them at home.
It's interesting you'd say that. I've heard many political scientists actually make that remark about exporting democracy. Well, why don't we fix ours first? And that sounds like the place to bring in Tim Lynch.
I think it's a good question, but if you make your foreign interventionism contingent on your domestic perfection, then you won't do anything. America would be a big insular power. We know it acts highly imperfectly, but on balance over the long term, what we've tended to prosper by, and by prosper I mean the delivery of freedom to people around the world, has been the product in the last 100 years of the application of American hard military power. Europe wouldn't exist in the form it does. Japan wouldn't exist in the form it does had America not waged war on them and in them. So I think in some ways this notion that you can replace this basic currency, hard American military power, with something nicer, a softer version, is problematic and not borne out by the historical record. So I think it's all very well to build a vocabulary of human rights and to trace this lineage, which I think is long and a very worthwhile thing to do, but we forget that the notion of human rights is contingent on their enforcement through power, through hard military power. And in the 20th century, that job has fallen to the United States.
I think many people would argue that there may have been excessive force in most of these cases, in which there was so much loss of human life and other very important aspects of humanity that it's hard to justify the other side.
I think it's an argument worth having.
So, Elizabeth Borgwardt, let's bring you back in on this.
Again, historians never like to talk very much about the future, but I think that this idea of, I mean, I'm so happy that Professor Lynch was talking about power, because I think a lot of particularly human rights specialists sort of shy away from these kinds of terms, and even in international relations, it's how do you talk about the interaction of, say, power and culture. I was talking about the Helsinki effect, so-called, earlier from that 1975 moment of having an ideology, you know, inspire a social movement that then led to changed expectations and reconfigured politics. But we could even look now at, for instance, the Arab Spring. You know, who knows what the future of Arab Spring is? But it strikes me as patronizing to say, well, you know, human rights are a Western construct. You know, they're not for you because they're not indigenous. So you know, why don't you come up with some other way of framing your aspirations? Young people in the different Arab Spring movements have taken these ideas that maybe were publicly articulated in a more Western idiom initially, but they've really made them their own.
In terms of the concepts we're talking about, bring in the concept that Joseph Nye uses, soft power, persuasive power, power of ideas. How does that fit in with American history, Chris McKnight-Nichols?
It strikes me that both Tim's and Liz's points here intersect with another interesting aspect of American ideology in terms of foreign policy, and that is the ways, the sort of unintended consequences that American policymakers' rhetoric can entail. So a great example, Liz's work, for example, on the Atlantic Charter, and which she calls sort of a New Deal for the world, emerging even before America begins to fight the Second World War, or thinking about some of the paradoxical ways that isolationism emerges as something that cuts short annexations abroad, or American interventionism in my work. Or another example that comes to mind is Erez Manella's book, The Wilsonian Moment, which details how in Egypt, India, China, Korea, and beyond, sort of Woodrow Wilson's ideas about the 14 points, his call for a free, open-minded, absolutely impartial adjustment of colonial claims, often configured as self-determination, really resonated with nationalists around the world in ways that Wilson himself didn't foresee and didn't particularly like. So some of the ways in which American foreign policy ideology plays out can be problematic, but actually can also be deeply empowering on a world stage.
Sometimes leaders say things and mean something completely different. And I think, Liz Borgwardt, that was one of the things that you wrote about, that it is interpreted in one way, whereas the leader means something completely different. Perhaps look at what the underlying intentions sometimes are. It sometimes is this rhetoric of human rights really an excuse for building power or building economic superiority or something to that effect? What do you think?
Well, I'm often asked a variation of the question, you know, aren't human rights just a mask for imperialism? And, you know, I mean, it reminds me, it's a sort of international version of when I'm asked about, I often teach about the New Deal, and so the question will be, you know, wasn't the New Deal just a mask for stabilizing capitalism? And with both of those questions, for me, the key word is the word just, because it was that, but it was some other things too, and so too with human rights, where it's there are moments of great fluidity in international politics where you can have things can be tugged in a somewhat more progressive direction. And you mentioned leaders meaning something different. I mean, that classic example in my book is the arch-imperialist Churchill, you know, articulating some of the most highfalutin phrases in the Atlantic Charter about all the men in all the lands living out their lives in freedom from fear and want. That's actually, he was paying a compliment to FDR by sort of quoting Roosevelt back to himself. But he was then asked in the British House of Commons if that applied to British colonial possessions in India and Africa. And he stood up and said, you know, I didn't become the king's first minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. I meant it for an inspirational value to help bring the United States in to support us.
Tim Lynch?
Well, I think this is a very interesting discussion. My concern in the discussion we're having is that if we disconnect concepts like human rights and exceptionalism from the capacity to enforce them and realize them, I think we have a problem. One of the great ironies in American history is that as America has got more powerful, and this bucks the trend, a thickening of international law. International law is the tool of the powerless. It's what you insist on when you haven't got the capacity to realize your ends through other means. Whereas the United States, and this is part of its exceptional character, has been at the forefront of international human rights regimes, of international law, as a way of building in its rule of law concept at home at a global level. I think that still requires understanding and recognition.
Chris McKnight-Nichols?
It strikes me that ideological positions have remained relatively fluid in American foreign policy, but there are some strong examples of those from Jefferson and Madison responding to British trade restrictions in the early 19th century, or Wilson in the League of Nations. When American policymakers have refused to compromise, they've met defeat. But you've also had examples, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger's kind of realism, sometimes described as amoral realism, also couldn't really survive indefinitely without firmer foundations in maybe the nation's more, what we might call, more well-revered past principles. So it seems to me that we're struck with a kind of deep paradox about ideology in American foreign policy, that perhaps the most widespread belief, something that we've all been talking about today, is that American foreign affairs is a peculiar aspect of American history and that it has a sort of exceptionalist model. This is something that foreign policymakers have almost always wanted to attend to. And yet, the American public, at least historically, hasn't made many demands on policymakers to get deeper inside their ideologies, to understand more fully what ideologies guide our foreign policies. And so I wonder, as an open question in the 21st century, whether or not the American people, in terms of democratic accountability, will ask more about the ideologies of their presidents in terms of foreign policy.
That's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you to the three of you, Elizabeth Borgwardt, professor of history at Washington University and University of Chicago, and author of A New Deal for the World, America's Vision for Human Rights, and the forthcoming The Nuremberg Idea, Crimes Against Humanity in History, Law and Politics. Tim Lynch, professor in the School of Social Sciences and Political Sciences at University of Melbourne, author of publications including Turf War, the Clinton Administration in Northern Ireland, and also the forthcoming Cambridge Essential History of Post-Cold War U.S. Foreign Policy, and Christopher McKnight Nichols, who's been with us once before, who is at the University of Pennsylvania and a professor of history at Oregon State University, author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of the Golden Age. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Great. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
The Pacifica Radio Archives needs your help so we can restore and preserve another of our 55,000 reel-to-reel tapes in our collection.
I get upset when, even with my own children, I have to remind you, you know, you come from somewhere. You belong to a couple thousand year old family. And it's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
Go to PacificaRadioArchives.org.
We must admit the past. Only the person who knows her past, his past, can begin to essay where she or he is today and how she or he may begin to chart his tomorrow, her tomorrow.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.
Diving deeper.